You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today, we're bringing you an episode from Icons, where listeners are introduced to incredible people working within the law enforcement community who have made a profound impact in our world. These one-on-one interviews provide insight into their lives and careers so we can better understand their challenges and recognize their bravery, commitment, and sacrifice. On this episode of Icons, Thomas is joined by Lori Robinson, who has dedicated her life to criminal justice reform through groundbreaking programs and initiatives within the federal government. Lori twice served as a Senate-confirmed, presidentially appointed Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs, the Research, Statistics, and Criminal Justice Assistance arm of the department. Lori was the longest-serving head of the agency in its 50-year history. When asked about crime and affecting change, Lori asserts, "The more that we can think successfully rather than just emotionally in a reactionary way about what to do about crime, we're going to have an impact." And now for Icons, featuring Lori Robinson, a life of evidence-based leadership.
Well, thank you so much, Lori, for being here with us today and for being a part of this series.
Yeah, thank you.
So I wanted to start with a little tidbit that not many people might know about. Is there an award named after you?
Yes. Yes, there is.
And how did that happen?
Someone, and I'm not sure who, when I was Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, someone at the Office of Justice Programs, which was the agency I headed, recommended this to the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. And as I was near the time of leaving the department in 2012, I was surprised when it was announced that this award was being created and that the Attorney General, Eric Holder, would be coming to our agency to present the first award. So I was really bowled over by that.
Wow, I imagine so. And one day, I think there might be a Thomas K. Canavan Award. And so I need to figure out how to get it. And this whole interview may have been designed for me to learn how I go about doing that. So let's start from the very beginning and get a little bit about your background, where you're from and your family and just for fun, the first job that you ever had.
I thought you were going to say how you go about kind of duplicating getting a Justice Department award named after you. But if it's wide open, maybe you have a good chance.
Okay, good. That's encouraging.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., so being a Washington native is actually somewhat unusual these days because most of our population here in the District of Columbia is made up of people who have moved here. But I was born in Washington. My parents were both from the Midwest, from North Dakota. They had come to Washington with the New Deal, around the time of the Second World War. And my father worked with a New Deal program called the Rural Electrification Administration. And when I was a little girl and growing up in Washington, and they had moved by that time out to Northern Virginia to Falls Church, Virginia. And my father, in the time I was growing up, worked on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist for the rural electrification co-ops around the country. And I mention that because it became a big interest of mine, both history and politics, because I heard a political discussion all of the time at home around the dinner table. He would be raising questions with Capitol Hill about appropriations for the rural electric cooperatives. And there was strong bipartisan support for that program, which was in the Department of Agriculture. And my father was, I think, very good at working the Hill. And it was a time that was pretty different from now, in that lobbyists worked directly with senators and with members of the House. There were many fewer staff on Capitol Hill at that time. And I remember him introducing me and my sister to John Kennedy and other people up there. In fact, I was an usher as a girl in John Kennedy's inauguration.
Oh, wow.
And there was a huge blizzard at that time. And the parade route was not that crowded because of that. And John Kennedy and his wife, Jacqueline, waved to a small group of us ushers who were kind of huddled on the stands because it was there had been such a huge snowstorm the night before. But that was kind of the setting that interested me so much in public policy eventually. My real love of particularly American history and politics and political campaigns. So that's kind of a backdrop to my growing up in this area. And you also asked about my first job. I moved to New York after school and worked for a wire service up there. My parents had both started out being journalists in North Dakota. That's where they met on a newspaper. And my brother has worked most of his career. He's retired now, but worked for National Public Radio, for NPR, covering a lot of political issues. And so it was not surprising that I wanted to initially be working in the journalistic area.
How did you get to the Department of Justice?
Well, I ended up moving back to the Washington area and worked for the American Bar Association. I worked there for many years. I headed the section of criminal justice for the ABA. And one of the many people who I got to know who were members of the American Bar Association was the state's attorney in Miami, Florida, a woman named Janet Reno, who you probably remember Bill Clinton turned to in 1993 to become his attorney general. And she was someone I knew well, had worked with a great deal during my time at the American Bar Association. And she asked me to join her at the department. What's interesting is that I loved my job at the ABA, and I actually thought long and hard about whether to leave the ABA and go to the Justice Department. And I kind of both chuckle about that now, thinking back on that, and also kind of admonish myself thinking back on that, because it was such a great opportunity that subsequently led to so many other wonderful opportunities that I can't believe that I didn't immediately just say yes. But I did, luckily, say yes and joined her at the Justice Department.
At the American Bar Association, what role did the criminal justice division play within that association? Was it a source of resources for attorneys? What was the role within that association?
The ABA has 20-some different sections, which are membership sections. In other words, we had at that time, I think there were roughly 10 or 12,000 members of the American Bar Association who were also members of the section of criminal justice, because they either were interested in the issues around criminal justice or were practitioners in the criminal justice area or law professors in that area or both. But they could have been litigators in some other area who simply cared about issues, let's say, about juvenile justice or issues relating to prisons and jails, etc. And a great deal of what was done by the criminal justice section was what I was interested in, which was develop policy proposals for Congress or state legislatures in different areas, whether it was on issues like sentencing or grand jury reform or juvenile justice or a whole panoply of other issues on policing or et cetera. Then advance those questions and proposals to the full American Bar Association for its decision-making body called the House of Delegates, would testify before Congress or state legislatures, put out publications, et cetera.
So when Attorney General Janet Reno invited you to come to the Department of Justice, mm-hmm. what was your role there?
Oh, she asked me initially come to the Department of Justice as an associate deputy attorney general. And the deputy attorney general is the number two person in the Justice Department, essentially kind of the chief operating officer. An associate deputy attorney general is one of a number, usually maybe four or five or six deputies to the deputy attorney general. And I was particularly interested in the issue of sentencing the potential to work with the United States Sentencing Commission and that set of issues. But very shortly, right before I went to the department, because anytime you're asked to do something in a federal job, they may ask you, and then it takes weeks until you're actually going in the door mm-hmm. Because of clearances and the like. I had a call from the department asking if I would also serve as the acting assistant attorney general at the Grants and Research Agency, the Office of Justice Programs, because the person who had been slated to go there as the permanent assistant attorney general, an individual who I knew and thought very highly of, was being dropped as the nominee because they discovered that he'd never paid any federal taxes for about 10 years.
Well.
That's not something you should probably do if you're going for
That's
a federal
right.
job.
You're right.
So I went in with not one but two assignments, which was, I would say, as a footnote, a little overwhelming.
I would imagine. Yes. So in your long list of accomplishments within the role of the Assistant Attorney General for OJP, you were able to grow the budget for that department from $800 million to $4 billion. Is that right?
That's correct.
So what was happening at that time that gave you the path to do that? How was that possible?
Well, it is an unusual jump in budget.
It's big. Significant.
I would agree. But there were things that were far beyond my control. I would like to say that I just wowed everybody and that
sure.
happened. But that was not the case. The setting from a national standpoint was the backdrop, the environment nationally. There was rising crime, and with that, and part of the real reason for that rising crime was the fact that there was a national crack cocaine epidemic in the country. There was public distress about that because of the crime that was associated with it. There was huge media attention to that. And with that, there was huge congressional and state legislative attention to that as well. So there was an uproar, real uproar about, you know, what is Congress going to do about this? What is the White House going to do about this? And with that, there was politics involved, of course. And with the election of 1992, with Bill Clinton coming into the White House in 1993, and with the Congress focused on these issues in both parties, it was not one party. In fact, each party tried to one-up the other with more and more proposals to heighten sentences, et cetera. And in 1993, there were different proposals being put on the Congressional House and Senate floors for consideration and long debate. All of that resulted in passage in September of 1994 of what was then and still is called the crime bill. Mm. And there were literally dozens and dozens of new grant programs proposed in the crime bill, most of which leaned toward not the prevention side, though there were some of those, but mainly toward longer sentences, mandatory sentences, and a variety of other approaches. But with that, there were also innovative programs, for example, on violence against women, on drug court programs that included treatment and an ability to really hold people accountable, but not have them just thrown in jail so they're back the next week or 2 weeks after release because they're still addicts. So these were innovative programs that still, and I can cite you examples if we have time, that have had a real, very real impact over time, just to cite the drug courts for one moment. And the drug court program started nationally with the crime bill. There were 11 drug courts in 1994-95 nationally. There are over 3,000 today. Mm, wow. And it all started on the national front with the money from the crime bill. But to go back to kind of the nuts and bolts of this, the crime bill provided funding in the billions for the Bill Clinton's $100,000 cops on the street, not $100,000, 100,000 cops on the street that he'd promised in his election campaign. But so many other things along the lines of what I've been mentioning, from violence against women to the drug courts, to drug treatment in prisons, to a variety of other tough programs, and a few, as I said, prevention programs. All of these various programs were assigned the way the legislation is written to the Attorney General. And then the decisions were made about where to assign them within the Justice Department for implementation. And most of the programs were assigned to the Office of Justice Programs. So that's how this gets actually handled from an implementation standpoint. And that's how OJP's budget grew and grew quickly. And we also were then assigned the ability to staff slots. So we grew from 300 and some staff to over 800 within
OJP.
Within OJP in just about a year. So that was...
That's a massive scale-up.
Yes, and also, though it's a technical point, we were given the ability to hire them under an expedited, what's called Schedule A, so you didn't have to go through as bureaucratic a process in hiring. You could do it more expeditiously. And that kind of thing makes a big difference because you can get people on board probably three or four times as quickly as through the traditional and very laborious civil service process.
When I read the statement that you oversaw the largest increase in federal spending on crime-related research mm-hmm. in the nation's history, I think about where the budget began mm-hmm. for that department and then where it grew. And I'm curious your thoughts on would things, and I don't like to, you know, dwell in the past, but I think we can learn from this situation. Had we had more resources beforehand, mm-hmm. would we have been able to prevent what we saw during that time?
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful question. Remember, though, that of the $4 billion, most all of that is programmatic money, not research money, that's going out to states and localities for programmatic spending. Now, a little bit of that is spent by the states and localities on research, but the research money itself was probably in the hundreds of millions maximum, maybe a couple hundred million. It's not anywhere near even half a billion. But your point is very well taken, in that if we had invested more research, more money in research, could we have changed our approach so as to prevent some of the, let's say, approach to dealing with the crack cocaine addiction problem that had triggered at least some of the crime and the way that we had dealt with it? And I think the answer is yes, though one of the key issues with research is you can have good research produced, but how is it then translated and how do you get it to sure. policymakers? Mm-hmm. Are they listening? Can they, will they, are you credible to them? Will they act on it? Will they pay any attention to it? Mm-hmm. So all of that has to be factored in as well. But your basic point is a very important one. And this is something that I felt was critical, that you don't just send it off to universities to do academic research and write journal articles, because I've never seen anybody on Capitol Hill who's been elected to Congress reading a lot of journal articles.
Yep, that's true. As the longest serving assistant attorney general over the House of Justice programs, you had the opportunity to work in two administrations under Attorney General Reno and Attorney General Holder. What were some of the differences between those two administrations and maybe some similarities?
Well, that's a great question to ask. First of all, it was an honor to serve in both of those, and I hadn't intended to go back in the Obama-Holder administration. I did work some in the campaign for President, soon to be at that point President Obama, and I had known Eric Holder from his time as the Deputy Attorney General under Janet Reno, but I, at that point, was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, like my time at the ABA, I really loved my job. I loved the students. And I had served in the Justice Department. So I ended up serving on the transition team for the Obama administration once he was the president-elect. But there was one other person who was serving on the transition team, which had about 20 people for the Justice Department. And the other 18 people, other than this fellow I'm mentioning and myself, everybody else was vying for jobs. What job can I get in this incoming administration? I wasn't, and this other guy wasn't. We kind of joked about it, that we could be kind of relaxed because we weren't looking around every corner, seeing what job we could get, which also made it easier to do what they'd asked us to do, which is come up with recommendations on what needs to happen. But in any case, that was also around the time that, with the recession that was occurring at that point, that Congress and the incoming administration was looking at passing, and I can't remember what it was called at this point, but a large piece of legislation to help stir the economy and really put money back in to stimulant bill. And money was coming to the Justice Department and specifically to OJP. And Eric Holder was really concerned about, with several billion dollars coming into OJP for new grants, he wanted somebody there who he could really trust to oversee that money. So he started leaning on me about coming back and leaning. Short story is I ended up agreeing, but that was after he had called me into his office, and I told him I really can't. He said, well, bring your list of reasons you can't, and then we'll go over them. And so I went over them, and then he said, and the last thing on my list was, my husband doesn't think it's a great idea. And he knows Sheldon, so he called his assistant in, and he said, Annie, get Sheldon Krantz on the phone for me. Sheldon's with a big law firm, actually very close to here. And so they called Sheldon out of a meeting. The attorney general's on the phone for Sheldon Krantz. And so I was hearing just one half of the conversation, but I could tell that Eric was like, oh, that's good. Yeah, great. Anyway, so he turned his mind around. Anyway, I went back for 3 years. But so that's just a brief kind of anecdote about Eric Holder's persuasive talents.
Mm-hmm, right.
I would say in both administrations, I think one thing that made it very helpful for me was that I had an existing relationship with the Attorney General that I didn't want to take advantage of. I didn't try to call them all the time or anything. But when I needed to meet with them, or there was something that was a very important issue, I knew I could reach out to them, which I did. So that was important. And importantly also, I knew in each case that they shared my values and goals. One of the things I talked to Eric Holder about in terms of my what I would view as my important goals if I did come back was the whole issue of science and evidence. And Eric Holder embraced that completely, and that, as well as, you know, my husband's support and change of mind, which I was joking about, was really pivotal. The fact that he said that he would be completely supportive and make those department goals, so it would not just be about OJP. He would think of that very broadly as far as setting department policy. And I'll tell you, he followed through on that in every way. And that made a very significant difference. Because at the Justice Department, there's very much a lawyer culture. Not surprisingly, it's made up of lawyers primarily, other than the law enforcement components. And so his embrace of that and his engagement with the work on science was very significant. But I want to also step back and talk about some differences between the two administrations broadly. For one thing, Eric Holder was very close to President Obama. They had a relationship going back a number of years, and he had a very good and strong relationship with the White House as a result. And that was helpful in lots of ways. Whereas Janet Reno really felt strongly about the importance, not that Eric Holder didn't, but he still, but Janet Reno felt that it was important to have a very distant relationship with the president. And she carried that to the point of having a distant relationship with the entire White House, which at times was a little difficult for the Department of Justice. And you may not remember these particulars, but she ended up appointing special counsel in a number of cases where there were issues raised about some of the cabinet members in the Clinton administration, and that caused resentment. I mean, the special counsel statute allowed her to do this, but it's an awkward thing. But she's passed away now, but she was a very independent person generally and wanted to just keep arm's length. But it made for a difficult relationship more broadly between the Justice Department and the White House. Another broader comment about or comparison between the Clinton White House and the Obama White House is that the Clinton White House was, not surprisingly with Bill Clinton, very, very political. He had some very, very astute political people there. And I think that they were very skilled at being able to identify political opportunities for identifying, let's say, grant programs that should be highlighted or those kinds of things. But at times, and this is just my observation, I felt like they were more interested in the political side of it than the substantive side. On the other hand, I felt that the Obama administration sometimes was so substantive that they sometimes missed some of those political opportunities. Just as an example, we tried to encourage them to do events for National Crime Victims Week, bring in law enforcement, bring in crime victim advocates and crime victims and such, and they always seemed disinterested. And that was hard for me to understand. I tried to encourage more discussion about those kinds of things. And so somehow that there was just a different kind of focus, I guess I would say, between the two. But there was a tremendous amount of interest on the Obama administration's part in so many important issues on youth violence and how to approach that and to include both community and law enforcement. And, you know, so they had a very good holistic approach, and that was really welcomed.
It's very interesting to compare the two.
Yeah.
When you were at OJP, you oversaw big reorganization. Is that right?
Well, I tried to.
Yeah.
And this was during the 90s, yeah.
So this was then under Attorney General Reno.
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about what was occurring. And so was it you know, relative to just you coming on board at the time and kind of ramping up, or was there systemic things that were happening that you mm-hmm. saw that just needed to change in order mm-hmm. to move forward?
Yeah. Well, this was back in the late 90s. So this is after I had been on board there for probably over 5 years and had a good take on what was how the place operated. And what I saw, and I discussed this with our congressional oversight on both sides of the aisle and our appropriators. And one thing, just as a footnote, I learned a lot going back to my upbringing. I learned a lot from my father about his approach to working with the Hill. And one of the key points, even though I grew up in a strongly Democratic family, was the importance of being very bipartisan in how you would do work with the Hill. And I tried to implement that all the time that I worked at OJP, because I may have been appointed by a Democratic president, but my job at OJP, I felt, was as an executive branch person implementing laws that Congress had passed. And therefore, that it was really important to try to work with whoever was in, you know, was chairing the committee that you were working with, whether judiciary in our case or appropriations, or was the ranking. Tried very hard to do that, and I think was very successful at it, because there's oftentimes in federal bureaucracies kind of a an attitude of, you know, resistance to sharing a lot of information, because they're a little scared about maybe people on the Hill are going to be critical of them, or it's not going to, whatever. It's kind of, you know, circle of the wagons. No matter who's in charge, it's not a political thing per se, it's a bureaucratic thing. And my view was we needed to be transparent. We needed to, like, share information. And so once I got those channels more open. So people on the Hill were really grateful about that. You should just be open with them. If we don't have the information, tell them that, but we'll get it together for them. And, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer in a way. In any case, I had a good relationship. And one of the things I talked to the folks on the Hill about were some of the obstacles that we experienced because of the structure of OJP. The predecessor agency to OJP, which had been established in the late 60s, called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEAA, was just a regular agency that was headed by a one person and just operated as a regular agency with different divisions. But when OJP was created, with all of the separate bureaus, each of these bureaus was headed by a presidentially appointed director or administrator. And what that did was create different fiefdoms, basically, that didn't cooperate with each other and tried to be unbeholden to either the assistant attorney general or even to the attorney general. And so that created a lot of problems of coordinating the program itself, and also to, just from a organizational and bureaucratic standpoint, getting the staff to work with each other. And so I worked with several of my staff to just put together a simple report saying what kind of overlap and duplication this led to. For example, that gang issues we found were being analyzed and dealt with by four of the five different bureaus that we had. I remember child abuse was also dealt with by most of them. Human trafficking was being dealt with by most of these different bureaus and so on. Hate crime was another that was being looked at and researched and dealt with by a lot of them. So there was insufficient coordination, and it also led, since human beings often are this way, to so many turf wars. I remember the head of the Juvenile Justice Office came to me one day and said that the head of the Bureau of Justice Assistance was going to be had a conference going, but wouldn't share the stage with him because she wanted the glory all to herself. I mean, this is like kindergarten.
Right.
And, you know, human beings have enough of these kind of idiosyncrasies without having a structure that encourages it. So I engaged a consultant to give us advice on some ways that we could encourage a more streamlined or set up a more streamlined organization. Another thing was that we had two different bureaus doing research and two different bureaus doing statistics. When we had had and have a Bureau of Justice Statistics that one would think would do all the statistics, and a National Institute of Justice that should be doing all the research. So it was some simple things like that along the way as well. So I had that report written up, circulated it then to folks at OJP for comment. Some of them were delighted about it. The law enforcement community, by the way, was very happy about it. They had no problem with it. But again, and I fault myself for this, I had not probably, or in retrospect, probably very clearly, had not vetted some of these ideas enough with some of the constituent groups, because there were a lot of people who felt that their funding would be at risk from any changes. And so there was opposition that grew to any changes, because oftentimes people are happy with the relationship in particular that they have with their grant manager. It's a personal relationship that's been built up. And so they don't want any risk to that relationship that might occur if there were structural changes. And again, I had bipartisan support in the Senate, and it looked like the same in the House. But Janet Reno was very supportive of it. But it just failed to progress, and in part because the constituent groups, a number of them, were unhappy about it. And within the agency itself, there was, particularly from a couple of our presidentially appointed bureau heads, there was unease and opposition. So looking back on it, if I were doing something like that again, I would start with much more vetting of the ideas within the agency initially.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Currently, the Office of Justice Programs is defined as the Research, Statistics, and Criminal Justice Assistance arm of DOJ.
Yeah.
Was that how it was defined then, or has it become more defined over time?
Well, that's the way I describe it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it necessarily was described exactly like that then, but I think that description would fit. But I don't think going back to the initial creation of OJP after LEAA, after the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, that it necessarily would have been described that way.
One of the things that I know is very important to you, as we've heard it several times in this discussion already, is integrating evidence.
Yes.
And I'm curious if, you know, part of your work was integrating evidence into, I imagine, how decisions are made and programs are run. if evidence wasn't present, what was?
No, that's an excellent question. I'll divert to just tell a little story very quickly. When I was first at the American Bar Association long ago, and kind of a young pipsqueak, as I would say, starting at a fairly low level, and they sent me up to cover a hearing in the Senate on, I think it was probation and parole practices, and it was in connection with federal criminal code revision. And I thought, this is really exciting to see the great thoughts coming out from these members of the Senate and such. And in the first few minutes, one of the senators said, well, my brother-in-law once had a case, and that's what we should be doing here, blah, 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 blah. In other words, I felt so kind of dismayed, thinking, so the way they're making the decisions is so anecdotal. But sadly, so much policymaker decision-making or practitioner decision-making has traditionally been based on what somebody else has told them. And sometimes it's, like in the policing world, there's a lot of good craft that is based on the tradition and what has been learned on the street in the case of police officers that is experiential and very important. But we also need, you don't want random anecdote guiding, let's say, how we raise our kids, we wouldn't want the head of the National Institute of Cancer, or whatever the correct name is, coming in and saying, well, my brother-in-law once had a case, and I think that's the way we should do it, But that is how a lot of our thinking about crime prevention or ways to address crimes successfully have been handled over decades or centuries. And so the more that we can think successfully rather than just emotionally in a reactionary way about what to do about crime, we're going to have an impact.
Yeah, and what may work in one area where his brother-in-law lived, yes. may not work in another.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to hear from you a little bit in your own words, the connection between science and justice. And when I think of science, I think of experiments and testing hypotheses, and sometimes those experiments not going the way we thought, and that's part of the process.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious how that's applied within the criminal justice field, and within the scientific model, we have there's space for failure. It's part of the process. And is there room for failure? Do we build that into the criminal justice field so that we can learn how to get it right?
Yeah, well, that's again an excellent question, Thomas. And it has to be built in, even though in the academic world, I think that there is a bias against that because people want results to write up and be published.
Right.
So that tends to cut against that. But there needs to be space for that because we learn from those failures. Thinking back to whatever Thomas Edison said about how many trials he had before he got the successful light bulb or whatever that, I forget, 100 and then the one that worked or whatever it was. But I do think that the connection between science and justice is that justice is also about values. And there's nothing from science that is going to tell us whether we want a 14-year sentence for something versus a 2-year sentence, or if a state is going to adopt the death penalty or not. There might be things that will shed light on that or inform a decision, but it's not going to make the decision. But in terms of looking at impact, science and evidence can certainly shed light. And I think those are tools that we need to think about and utilize.
What was the role of the Science Advisory Board that you formed?
Yeah. Well, the Science Advisory Board is something that I had thought about a good deal. And then the National Academy of Sciences came out with a very thoughtful and thorough report about strengthening science in the National Institute of Justice. And they also echoed, they had not talked to me and I had not known about their thinking about this. But that report came out just a month or two after I had talked to Eric Holder about appointing something like that. So that strengthened our hand.
That's interesting. They weighed in.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. They did it without knowing we were thinking about it and vice versa. The role that we saw was that they would be an advisory committee. I think that there is enormous value in having a body like that. And this was a body made up primarily of social scientists, but not exclusively. We had actually Bill Bratton was a member of it. And we had several other practitioners as well. We had a sheriff on it. We had, I'm trying to remember other practitioners, and I don't, but from several other fields as well. The primary goal was to, first of all, review and see kind of the state of science in the OJP agencies. Then to step back and provide advice to both the OJP leadership and also to the individual bureaus within OJP, which are the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which is the largest of the grant making agencies, the National Institute of Justice, the research agency. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and the Office on Victims of Crime, as well as several smaller offices. But those are the five big bureaus, about how they were conducting their work, basically, and whether there were other opportunities and ways of integrating science into the work that they had ongoing. Then there were several projects like the new What Works Clearinghouse Crime Solutions that we were setting up that could be strengthened. We turned to them for ideas and advice on how we were structuring that and how it could be most effective. So it was just getting their brain power in on how we were envisioning the integration of evidence into our work broadly.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you mentioned the crime solutions because I was looking at the about page. I was reading more about it. And the word evidence, no surprise, was the third most used word following and the.
I love it.
And so again, this tells me that, you know, evidence was and is an important part of this project. And so I wanted to just hear a little bit more about this clearinghouse, why it was established, and you know, what did it take to get that off the ground?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. When you leave a job, you oftentimes, I think, look back and think, why didn't I do X while I was still in that job? And when I left the Justice Department in 2000, the one thing I wished I had done was create a What Works Clearinghouse. And I kicked myself, and I thought, why in the world didn't you do that? And I testified before Congress several times after that. They asked me to come back and to the Appropriations Subcommittee for the Department of Justice. And each time I urged them, you should really, mandate a What Works Clearinghouse that can really aid the field and congressional staff and whoever could use this to really identify if somebody's looking for help on, dealing with domestic violence or hate crime or whatever. What does the science really tell us? So it's a quick way to really zero in on what the science, the state of the science on an issue. So when I did agree to go back to OJP, that was at the top of my list.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Top of my list. And I'd already talked to Eric Holder about it. He was 100% in agreement and behind it. And so on the first day that I assembled my staff in my immediate office, four or five people around, and I have to tell you, one of the people said to me, "We don't really need that. NIJ, National Institute of Justice, already does that." And I let loose some not very nice words.
I can't imagine.
Oh, yeah, I did. And she's actually somebody who's a good friend from a long way back. But I thought, this is a bureaucratic response.
Sure. Yep.
Because I knew this was not the case. You know, there's some, kind of vague way that you could, through a lot of research, use what's on the NIJ site. But no, it wasn't doing that. And so I just, but getting change in government, even though there are wonderful people who work for the government, getting change and making it happen, you have to be dogged, persistent, and sometimes mean, mm-hmm. a little mean, and keep kicking. So, yeah, this was a very high priority, and I had Eric Holder hand in hand with me on this. And that was in the spring of 2009, and it was the next year we got it kicked off, and he was there at the kickoff. But there is a lot to get done to make that happen. We had to enlist contractors and people who were knowledgeable to have them enlisted to actually, be reviewing studies and get this all in gear. And my understanding is that the new NIJ director, Nancy Lavine, who is excellent, very mm-hmm. excellent, is going to be or is already reviewing Crime Solutions to do some updating on it, which I think is good.
Good. Yeah, it was, like I said, poking around there recently, and it's a great site. And for everybody listening, it's crimesolutions.gov. And I encourage you to go there and take a look at what's there. Very important stuff. I wanted to jump over to your experience with the 21st Century Task Force on Policing. And I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about the task force itself and how you came to lead it with Commissioner Ramsey.
Well, thank you. First of all, being asked by the White House, by President Obama, to serve as the co-chair with Chief Ramsey was, one of the great honors and really highlights of my career, maybe my life. I mean, it was a enormous amount of work to do that, but really an enormous a challenge and learning experience. And what's interesting is there were 9 people on the task force, and we have remained close, even where are we now, 7 years later, which is really interesting. It was a very bonding experience for all of us. And working with Chuck Ramsey, I mean, he is a gem. He's just an incredible person, as I think you know. Mm-hmm. He is deeply, deeply knowledgeable about these issues and his wisdom about policing. I did feel fairly unequal in that regard, but boy, did I learn a lot from him. To step back and just tell you very quickly, the request to do this came completely out of the blue, and it was over Thanksgiving weekend in 2014. This was a number of months after the summer when Michael Brown had been killed on the streets of Ferguson, as you know. The grand jury had met in the fall, in November, and come back with no indictment against the officer. And you may recall that there were real protests in Ferguson and that area following the decision of no indictment. And the president made the decision, President Obama, to put together a task force to look not at the particular incidents that had occurred in Ferguson or any other particular incident, but to address the question of how greater cooperation and bonds could be created and encouraged between law enforcement and communities. And he asked us to this task force to delve into that and to do it very quickly. So a call came from his counsel on that Saturday, Thanksgiving that year in 2014. Neil Eggleston was his counsel. He pressed me about it. I agreed to do it. He said, "You'll be vetted tomorrow," which was the Sunday. And he said, "On Monday morning, you'll be meeting in the Oval Office with the president." So wow. It was on a very, very fast track. And now, as a longtime Washingtonian, I thought, well, and we first met with Neil Eggleston. And I thought, I'm going to really press Neil about whether we can have maybe 4 or 5 months to do this, because this is going to be a big task. And that was fine with Chuck. You know, he was then the police commissioner in Philadelphia. And I'd known Chuck for a number of years and knew that he had his hands full in Philadelphia, too. So I knew he would probably want more time as well. Anyway, Neil was fine with that request. We then went in to meet with the president in the Oval Office. We chatted for a little bit, and then the president called in the press. And he announced to the press, talked a little bit about us. Then he announced to the press, "And they'll have the report to me March 1st. So I looked at Chuck. Chuck looked at me, and I was going to say, "Oh shit!" You can probably take that out.
Nope, it's in.
Okay, fine with me. And That's what we did. We got the report to him on March 1st.
Wow.
And we really only had 2 months, not three. That was December 1st. We were meeting with him. But by the time they appointed the other members and the holidays went by,
right,
we didn't meet until early January. Mm. So we had to do, we did some hearings around the country. We obviously had to come up with who we were inviting to those hearings. We got a tremendous number of people writing to us, et cetera. I had a very easily accessible email address through the university, George Mason University. I had 500 and some emails myself. And, you know, at a public university, you don't have anybody assisting you.
Right.
I answered every one of those emails. Mm. So we took the testimony and then did our deliberations and such. But let me back up for a moment and say, the president and his team were wonderful in getting Chuck's and my input on the members of the task force, in that Chuck and I felt very strongly that it was very important to have people who would work well with each other. Because in any field, there are some people who are somewhat, let's say, prima donnas. Mm-hmm. But we had a really good team that worked well. And one thing that is really, I think, important to note is that we were able to come to consensus on every one of the recommendations. That's pretty unusual.
Wow, 59?
59 recommendations, yeah. And that doesn't even include the subpoints mm-hmm. under those recommendations.
In that short of time, that's incredible.
Yes.
Yeah.
I almost think, oddly, that if we'd had a year, we might have not been able to do that.
Yep.
Because sometimes when you linger a long time,
yep.
people go back and let's rewrite this one, let's rewrite that one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
maybe President Obama knew that.
Yeah, I know.
He saw that.
I think, you know? Yeah. But yep. he knew he needed to get those report recommendations out because he was fearful about the summer.
Sure.
Is there going to be, you know, real reaction on these issues? And he, one of the most brilliant people I've ever been around. He is an incredibly smart person.
Wow. I wanted to jump into the report a yeah. little bit around one of the key points, which is trust and legitimacy.
Yeah.
And I wanted to start with what it looks like in a community when there is no trust.
Yeah.
And the community doesn't feel that the department is legitimate in some way, right? So mm-hmm. we take those words and apply it in a community. What are some of the characteristics of that?
Yeah. Well, I'll again share just a very brief anecdote. But I remember after the unrest in Baltimore following, this is in the spring of 2015, as I recall, following Freddie Gray's death in that police van, and enthusiastic but unknowledgeable reporter, young woman reporter, said to me, called me, and she said, "Well, is the police department now going to be trying community policing?" And I tried to bite my tongue, and I said kindly, I hope, you don't start community policing when there is no basis for a relationship at this point. And so I think that's an example where until you've established some of that trust and some of that legitimacy, where there's a broken bond, you can't go out and start doing community policing or having an ongoing rapport. And I will also cite an example that we had without going into names and the site, but of a chief who testified before us citing how, as a new chief moving to a new city where there had been a lot of problems, that he just went out to community meeting after community meeting and listened and just heard over and over stories and examples from people living there. So I think that that's one of the many steps that can be taken to establish trust and establish relationship. And in many cases, this is not just with people that you'd like to hear from, maybe a few ministers who are, have had an ongoing relationship with the police agency, but with people who are difficult to listen to because they're not going to be polite, perhaps, in your view, but are going to be pretty rough on you. But that's what has to happen, to have that ongoing set of listening sessions. And then to begin to say, and what can we do? What can we do? So it's not surprising in a way, but it's trying to reestablish an open line of discussion and communication.
Of the 59 recommendations that were in the report, and that was 2015?
15 when it came out.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which one do you think would be most important right now in 2022?
Well, I still think that the one or ones on trust and legitimacy are, and coupled with that, because they're part of that in my view, the recommendation around procedural justice, which is really about treating people fairly and with an open mind and kind of transparency, is really critically part of that, particularly in light of the expectations in some communities that they won't be treated that way. But procedural justice is also the same thing that any of us want, whether we're renewing our driver's license at the Division of Motor Vehicles, mm-hmm. and you're waiting in a long line and nobody's telling you why the line is so long or how long you're going to have to wait, or you feel like you're treated rudely when you get up to the front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about treatment by government authority,
mm-hmm.
and how you... whether you feel like you've been treated fairly, impartially, and equitably. So that procedural justice is a very important piece of this as well.
Do you think that we would benefit from having another task force like this on a national scale, or do you think it's better to leave it up to the individual state and community? But do you think that the role of a task force that's looking at the current state of law enforcement across the country is important to continue doing periodically or in some interval?
Well, I'm kind of torn about it. When the Biden administration came in and there was talk about there being another task force, I thought, on some days I thought, well, maybe that's a good idea. On other days I thought, it's kind of duplicative
mm-hmm.
of what we did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that calling attention to the issue is very important. But the best way to do that, I'm not sure. And I generally have strong views about things. So I'm not sure why I'm a little up in the air about that. But I'd hate to see a rerun of the entire task force endeavor, because, and this I do have strong views on, the task force work has stood the test of time. And by the way, there's rarely a week that goes by that I still don't have press calls about the task force recommendations or someone
wow.
of them. And I still see from IACP or PERFs or other press clips about something relating to the task force recommendations. So that's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or read something about someone involved with something relating to some of the recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
A study, I guess it was this past year, that the Joyce Foundation funded for the National Policing Institute found that of a survey of police chiefs, just a little over half said that the task force recommendations had been moderately to very important in guiding change in their departments. So it's...
Wow.
Yeah. I guess as somebody who is a little bit jaded about all of the reports that come out every year in Washington, and, you know, the reality is that 6 months later, most of us don't even remember those reports.
Mm-hmm.
This report, and I don't just say that because I was part of it, but it's had staying power in the field. It's mm-hmm. hard to find a police chief who doesn't know about this report.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's had real staying power. And the reason is, I think, that it was derived from the field, from mm-hmm. research and from the field. And then it was put together in one document. And nobody said you have to implement all of them. It's like a resource.
Mm-hmm.
It's a resource for you. I mean, certainly there are certain themes in it, like the trust and legitimacy. But I've never heard anybody say, well, we don't believe in trust and legitimacy
mm-hmm.
or procedural justice. I mean, they're kind of basic things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all on some level can grow at different levels
yeah.
throughout the department. You
yeah.
know? Do you ever, you know, are you ever at 100% in all of them?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right. And so I think people view it as like a playbook.
Right.
A playbook and take from it what can improve their department with the goal of working in the best way they can with their community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you just brought up IACP and National Policing Institute.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about your role with these law enforcement associations,
yeah.
Most of whom make up our board of
yeah.
directors.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of them quite well. So I wanted to just kind of take this opportunity to hear how some of them are different from one another. Your role in each of them was largely around research,
mm-hmm.
you know, within IACP on the Research Advisory Council
yeah.
and, you know, looking at the work of the Council on Criminal Justice and National Policing Institute, all
mm-hmm.
very evidence-based. You know, type of work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit just for our listeners' sake about those associations and your work within them?
Oh, sure. Well, I've worked with IACP for decades, going back to when I was probably in the ABA, back when Dan Rosenblatt was the executive director. And then, as you're pointing out, when I was co-chair of the Research Advisory Committee for a number of years, but also certainly during both of my times at the Justice Department, worked very closely with them as well. And Vince Tolucci actually worked at OJP. That's when I first knew him. He was working with NIJ. IACP, a very strong support for the Research Advisory Committee, and I enjoyed my tenure there very much. PERF, I've known Chuck Wexler for many decades, and also think back to when Daryl Stevens was their executive director. And I always read Chuck's work with interest in his Saturday columns, which are great. The National Policing Institute, and I always still start to say National Police Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on their board actually twice, once in the 90s, and then I rejoined the board several years back, and I'm on their executive committee as well. I think Jim Birch is doing a terrific job there as their executive director, or president, I should say. They have a terrific board. I think it's been very good. Jim has brought some good people in. And Ron Serpas is their president now. I think with their hiring of Robin Engel as their vice president for research, that's a very strong hire to strengthen their research, not just the work, but kind of the profile of what they're doing, because she's just terrific and also has brought with her a large amount of work and of people who have been with her at the University of Cincinnati. So that is great. Who else was on your list?
Yeah, you have a long list, Laurie.
Yeah.
It was the Council of Criminal Justice.
I was just going to say, the Council on Criminal Justice is now just a little over 3 years old and modeled on the Council on Foreign Relations. Its president is Adam Gelb, who's the son of Leslie Gelb, who was the president of the Council on Foreign Relations for many years. So Adam had this vision and kind of brainchild notion of doing something similar to the Council on Foreign Relations for the criminal justice field. And my hat is really off to him, because anybody who would attempt to do this and carry forward on it during the pandemic, I mean, and he has been so successful doing it. He's raised a tremendous amount of money and launched a number of pretty incredible projects. There's one underway now about veterans justice, a commission on that. And it's co-chaired by Chuck Hagel and Leon Panetta. And it's a very strong group looking at the challenges that face veterans as they're leaving the military. And many of them at that point are vulnerable and get caught up in the criminal justice system. So this is a important issue and set of issues and area. So that's just one example. They've also come out with recommendations on policing, a policing task force, which really goes a number of steps beyond what we did in the White House task force. Mm-hmm. Their website is ccj.org. So I'd encourage people to look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about your work at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So you were the founding director for their criminology program, their master's program. Is that correct?
Well, I want to give credit to Dr. Larry Sherman, Lawrence Sherman, who was the founder of the criminology department at the University of Pennsylvania. And then I was the founding director of the MS program within that. But without Larry, I would not have been there on my own. So Larry, who's really probably the leading criminologist in the world, some say, he's really just sparks fly when he's around. He's a brilliant guy. But yes, I was the first of the directors of that program. And that was exciting to put together.
And when was that?
That was starting in 2004.
And tell us a little bit about what the process was. How do you add on to what's there already and really raise it to that level?
First of all, the Penn program, Department of Criminology, is the only criminology department in the Ivy League and continues to be the only one. And the Master of Science program in criminology, we just created it by within the Penn system, you know, proposing this to the graduate director in the School of Arts and Sciences. And his main question was, can it make us some money? We said, we think it can. And, you know, then they see whether you can produce. But it did. I mean, it was it drew in students. It was a success.
Did you like that aspect of your career, teaching and working within the academic field?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. I did. And I actually miss students at this point, having retired from teaching last year. And I still go in to teach an occasional class, maybe once a semester or so. Yes, I had, other than an occasional class here and there that I'd be asked to speak at, and that's really different from being responsible for a group of students over a semester, I had not taught before. I started in 2004 at Penn and then 2012 at George Mason. And I did. I loved working with students because having been very involved in a career previously in public policy, I loved the chance to share information with students and to work with them, to get involved with them. I'd always liked working, you know, being a supervisor with staff in my prior jobs. But this was working, obviously, with younger people generally. And I liked giving advice about transitioning into the workplace, and particularly about how they could best use their talents. And lots of students, even from Penn, still stay in touch with me. In fact, one of my students was just elected sheriff in a county in Massachusetts, where one of the primary jobs is not so much law enforcement as it is running the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his platform was that based on his some of his jobs, but also his degree from Penn, that he was going to overhaul the way the jail had been run to reflect evidence-based approaches and reduce the recidivism rate.
Wow.
Yeah, and the person who had been sheriff for 20 some years, he defeated him by just about half a point, a percentage point, and it was a very conservative person who kind of ran chain gangs and such. So that was kind of surprising.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of academic fields, sometimes you don't see the work that you do with the students.
Mm-hmm.
Applied in the field, and it must be amazing to see that happen.
Oh yes, it's great.
So, all right, to wrap this up, I think I've figured it out. If I want an award named after me, I need to lead a federal agency longer than anyone, totally transform the way it supports the criminal justice field or any field, be selected by the president to solve a national crisis, and create a graduate program at an Ivy League university. And with that said, I am doomed, because I don't think I'm going to be able to do any of those things. I don't think many people can. I think that is an incredible career, and I'm just honored to be able to have this conversation with you.
Oh, well, you're very, very kind.
Thank you so much again for being here. And before we go, I wanted to ask if you have a favorite quote that you'd like to share, or any just words of wisdom from Laurie Robinson for our listeners.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. I think the one thing that I always share with students, I always have a last class in which I share three or four points with them as they're perhaps moving out into the world, if not onto graduate school or more graduate school. And that is the importance of emotional intelligence. I think particularly in the academic world, there's such an emphasis on more degrees and the that side of learning. But I think, and I think that in law enforcement, the successful people, we can look up at so many of the people who are shown in this National Law Enforcement Museum and see, and we know that that emotional intelligence and dealing with people, whether they're in law enforcement itself or in the community, that the secret to success is understanding how people work. And I've said so many times to my students that I've known many, many extraordinarily bright people who have not been successful because they don't understand how to deal with people, whether it may be a support staff person or colleagues or maybe even their bosses. But they have not understood that it's not just all about them. I think we could see this in Washington certainly as well.
I agree. I think that's a much needed skill and ability is to have that emotional intelligence. Yeah. Couldn't agree. That's great advice.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much,
of course.
Thomas.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Laurie, for being here.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Icons, featuring Laurie Robinson and hosted by Thomas Canavan, the museum's executive director. We hope you found this conversation enlightening and will join us again for another edition of Icons, where we introduce listeners to incredible people working within the law enforcement community who have made a profound impact in our world. These one-on-one interviews provide insight into their lives and careers so we can better understand their challenges and recognize their bravery, commitment, and sacrifice. Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.